Andrew is going to be asking us, I think, probably one or two questions on our tables. So, as they say in the teaching profession, sit up straight, everyone, and pay attention. Thank you.
He's quite right. I have two warm-up questions. I always tremble with technology, as you can see, but at least we've got the first slide right. And two warm-up questions for you, just to get you tuned in. The first is a trivia question. And the second is a little bit more thoughtful question, and you've got 2 minutes in your tables to see if you can come up with the correct answer to number one and an interesting answer to question number two. Over to you. I can see one table's gone very quiet, so they've obviously got answers to both questions. So any ideas of the longest running BBC radio show? It's not a news program. It's a radio show, they call it. Any ideas? The Archers. Uh-huh. Any support? This table over here thinks it's the Archers. Any support for this table over here, the Archers? Any discordant voice? Pardon?
Desert Island Discs.
What did you say?
Desert Island Discs.
One answer is correct. The Archers, 1951. Desert Island Discs, 1942. Oh, indeed. Yes. Yes. Anybody ever been to a desert island? Nobody's been to a desert island. We, of course, we live on islands. We sometimes feel they're a bit deserted and so forth. So, yeah, okay. Right. Now, what about, of course, regularly the person appearing on Desert Island Discs is told, okay, on the island, we will give you the works of Shakespeare and the Bible. Well, what else would you like to take? What other book and so forth? I was thinking about books, and particularly whether the first chapter of a book has particular importance. So that's what lies behind my second question. Why do you think, is the first chapter of a book important? And if so, why? Any offers or suggestions? The importance of the first chapter of a book, any book, the book which you read or which you wrote for him. Does it get your attention? Yes, interesting.
Setting
a scene. Thank you. Any other suggestions? I heard something, but I didn't see where it was coming from. Ah, are you going to carry on? Yes, the first chapter of the book is very important. It may put you off it entirely and give up. Yep. And sometimes it does. That's right. It does indeed. Yeah. And of course, on the tables there are lots of copies of this book. I don't want you necessarily to look at just at the moment. And this book, actually, of course, we know it's a library of books. It has a first chapter. And in my experience of trying to teach teenagers many years ago in this famous city of Tunbridge Wells, I found that many of my students were entirely put off by chapter one. So they never reached chapter two, let alone the rest of the book. When I asked them, perhaps, they said, well, it's all about making the world in 7 days. And so, have you read it? I said. In most cases, they hadn't read it. But if they had come to RE following a science lesson, I can understand them having certain questions about the first chapter of this book and finding it somewhat confusing. The confusion, I think, is a failure to note what we're reading when we're reading Genesis chapter 1. And secondly, what Genesis chapter 1 is really all about. We've got to remember, of course, that this chapter 1 of Genesis comes from the Hebrew scriptures, from a part of the world which is very different from Royal Tunbridge Wells. We're in the Middle East. We're familiar with that part of the world, all too familiar, all too sadly familiar. But somewhere in that world, many years ago, maybe 5,000 years ago, Genesis chapter 1 was written. Who wrote it? I haven't a clue. When it was written? I haven't a clue. I know it was written in Hebrew, and that's a challenge in itself. Not that I know very much about Hebrew, but I know that it's different from English. You start reading it from the other side of the page. So whereas the first chapter of Genesis begins for us in our translation in the beginning up there in the Hebrew, it starts over here because they read from right to left. It's a different world. It's a different kind of literature that we quite often are familiar with. It is, in fact, in my perspective, when my students actually were as they were writing off this chapter, I went back and read it again, and I felt I was reading poetry. No wonder you won't find it in a science book. It seems to me, poetry, and poetry is a particular style of writing which has rhythm. It has rhyme sometimes. It has pattern of words. It has repetition and chorus. It appeals sometimes to the imagination. It makes us use the third eye as well as these two. It stirs our hearts. It moves us. It does all sorts of things which other forms of literature often don't. And as I read Genesis chapter 1, I feel I'm being invited to join a sightseeing tour of the universe. It'll take me away from this grey day for a week on tour. We should be exhausted by the end of it. It'll need to be followed by certainly a day of rest. And it all happens in a week. We're going to read it. There are three. You won't need the Bible. You can have it open certainly in front of you on Genesis. Well, we're going to read it, and it seems to me there are three voices involved. Here's one voice. Here's the second voice, and there's the third voice. And your voice, this is your line. I'm talking to the audience here. This is your line. And your line is going to come six times. And you can see, I've got it there, so I will tell you when to come in. You don't need to be looking at. I will tell you when to come in. But you notice that actually there's a problem because I've left out a word. Your line is exactly the same six times apart from one word which is different. I think you know what. It's the first time you're going to say it. There was evening and there was morning, the first day. That gives you the clue for the second time, the third time, and so on. So come with us on this sightseeing tour of the Milky Way from our perspective as men and women on planet Earth. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. Now the earth was formless and empty. Darkness was over the surface of the deep, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the waters. God said,
"Let there be light."
And there was light. God saw that the light was good, and he separated the light from the darkness. God called the light
day.
And the darkness he called
night.
God said,
Let there be an expanse between the waters to separate water from water.
So God made the expanse and separated the water under the expanse from the water above it. And it was so. God called the expanse
sky.
God said, let the water under the sky be gathered to one... Sorry, God said...
It's almost a trinity, but not quite, isn't it? Let the water under the sky be gathered to one place, and let the dry ground appear.
And it was so. God called the dry ground...
land.
And he gathered waters he called...
seas.
And God saw that it was good. Then God said,
let the land produce vegetation, seed-bearing plants, and trees on the land that bear fruit with seed in it, according to their various kinds.
And it was so. The land produced vegetation, plants bearing seed according to their kinds, and trees bearing fruit with seed in it according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. God said,
let there be lights in the expanse of the sky to separate the day from the night, and let them serve as signs to mark seasons and days and years, and let them be lights in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth.
And it was so. God made two great lights, the greater light to govern the day, and the lesser light to govern the night. He also made the stars. God set them in the expanse of the sky to give light on the earth, to govern the day and the night, and to separate light from darkness. And God saw that it was good. God said,
let the water teem with living creatures, and let birds fly above the earth across the expanse of the sky.
So God created the great creatures of the sea, and every living and moving thing with which the water teems according to their kinds, and every winged bird according to its kind. And God saw that it was good. God blessed them and said,
be fruitful and increase in number, and fill the water in the seas, and let the birds increase on the earth.
God said,
let the land produce living creatures according to their kinds, livestock, creatures that move along the ground, and wild animals, each according to its kind.
And it was so. God made the wild animals according to their kinds, the livestock according to their kinds, and all the creatures that move along the ground according to their kinds. And God saw that it was good. Then God said,
let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, over the livestock, over all the earth, and over all the creatures that move along the ground.
So God created man in his own image. In the image of God he created him. Male and female he created them. And God blessed them and said,
be fruitful and increase in number. Fill the earth and subdue it. Rule over the fish of the sea and the birds of the air, and over every living creature that moves on the ground. I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food. And to the beasts of the earth, and all the birds of the air, and all the creatures that move on the ground, everything that has breath of life in it, I give every green plant for food.
And it was so. God saw all that he had made, And it was very good. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. Genesis chapter 1, the first book of the Bible, the first chapter of the Bible. I'm puzzled why so many English translations of it make it end in chapter 2. So I have a question for you. You'd be surprised to hear that. The poem needs a title. I'm offering two possibilities. I'd like to know which you think is the better of the two titles for this poem that you have just been listening to and a part of, and in your mind's eye touring the universe as it was read. Over to you for 2 minutes. Which of these is the title, The Creation of the Universe, or is the title The Creator of the Universe? See what your friends on your table think and where your vote would go. Any table prepared to vote for option one, The Creation of the Universe? Any votes for that? Oh, some brave hands going up over here. The creation of the universe. Okay. Of course, maybe some people are going to say, well, I'm going to sit on the fence in this one, and I'm not going to vote either way, because he's probably got a trick up his sleeve anyway, and I don't want to get caught out and that kind of thing. But any votes for the second one? The best title, the better title for this poem is The Creator of the Universe. Okay, thank you. I think at one time I thought the first, but my students coming in and writing off chapter one of the Bible made me look at it again and think, no, I think the right title is number two. I gave you the first three words of the chapter in the beginning. What was the fourth? How many times in the chapter does this three-letter word, G-O-D, appear? Few or many? Many, you say. Yes, I counted them up again in the English translation of my book, and over 30 times in this chapter we get the word God. I wonder if the writer was trying to make a point here. The librarian is not going to put the Bible, according to chapter one of it, is not going to put this book in the cosmology section of the library, or the biology section of the library, but definitely the theology section of the library. Because theology is simply the study of God, biology the study of life, cosmology the study of the universe. Where is this book going to go? The librarian, I think, will put it in the theology section. In those days, of course, 5,000 years ago, there were lots of gods in the world. 2025? What's changed? It seems to me we're living in a world where there are lots of gods. I repeatedly hear almost every day somebody say, oh my God, and I want to say, oh, tell me about him. I haven't had the courage yet. In the beginning, God, we read. Which God is this? Important question. And if this is a book about theology, a very important question for the whole library of the Bible. What's this God like? Who is he? I think this piece of poetry introduces us to the God of the Bible as the maker of heaven and earth. And the poem tells us that he made it. So during the course of this week's tour, this sightseeing tour of the cosmos, of the Milky Way, the guide, was he the narrator or was he God in the poem? The guide encourages to look at various bits of the universe. Look at those trees over there. I want to tell you something about those trees. God made them. Look at those birds over there, flying in the sky. I want to tell you something about those birds. You see, God made them. I want you to look at look at the rivers and what's living in the rivers. I want to tell you something about that. God made them. That he made them. You're itching to say, how did he do it? How did he do it? How did he do it? What's the answer of the poem? All the poem says he spoke. So it doesn't help us very much to answer the question, how did he do it? The important question is that he did it. On a Monday morning, as a volunteer, I sought donations of a charity. And my colleague, the other side of the table, he does with bric-a-brac, and I do clothing and stuff. And he's with the bric-a-brac, he's always looking to see who made it. And sometimes who made it determines its value. That's why the Antiques Roadshow attracts us so much too. That he made it, not how. The poem tells us, secondly, not just that he made it, but that he made it all. So in this tour, we visit the planet Earth, and we visit the Milky Way, the galaxy in which planet Earth exists. And all over the place, wherever you look, God made it. Without him was not made anything that was made. And that's quite important. Because the temptation that human beings have fallen into is to make trees into gods or rivers into gods. We've had a terrible incident in India just recently of people dying during the course of a religious ceremony held at a river said to be sacred. And they were at worship of the river. So the river, they'd deified the river. It had become God to them. But Genesis 1, chapter 1 says you can't do that because God made the river. God the Creator is not to be confused with his creation. And so the God of the Bible is very different from the fertility gods of the ancient world where people worshipped the wind and the rain and the ability to make the ground fertile or whatever. And the God of the Bible is different from many of the religions of the world throughout human history, where God is confused with creation, and it is called pantheism. And the outstanding example of that would be Hinduism in the world. I'm not making a value judgment at the moment. I'm simply pointing out that the God of the Bible is different from the gods in many parts of the world then and now. He stands outside it, supreme. And then thirdly, I think this poem tells us that God made the heavens and the earth to a successful plan. We noticed in the course of the reading of the poem that there was the repetition of phrases, wasn't it? God said, and it was so, and God saw that it was good, and those kind of things were repeated throughout the poem. And God saw. saw that it was good suggests to me that there had been a lot of thought on behalf of the Creator. And a lot of pleasure when that thought had been translated into action and what he had designed in his mind became a reality, and he saw that what he had created brought him great pleasure. This is marvelous. This is the Creator in the poem gets a kick out of what he has created, and he stands back and has enormous pleasure in what he sees. So yes, there is order in the poem, conveyed chiefly by the idea of the 6 days. If I'd asked you, and I won't at this stage, if I'd asked you to put those 6 days in order, my guess is that you would have done that. So that's the order in the poem. Day one, day two, day three, day four, day five, day six. Putting in that order does create a certain amount of interesting and challenging and strange things, actually, because we have light on day one, but the sun on day four. For example. And some people have found this problematic. I was interested to find that one scholar of Genesis 1 suggested that they could be arranged in a different order. There is still order there, but supposing you put it like this. Do you see that there's a relationship with day one and day four, day two and day five, day three and day six? The second verse of Genesis chapter 1 says, "Now the earth was formless and empty, but by the end of the chapter, there is both form and life." Form and fullness. So you've got the environments in day 1, 2, and 3, and you've got the life living in those environments in day 4, 5, and 6. In the mind of the Creator, it wasn't just the environment that was important, it was the life that was to be found in those environments. I found that helpful and interesting and stimulating. And he looked out for all that he had made, and it was very good. Everything very good. In which case, we must be careful not to despise any bit of it, or write it off. As Paul says, it is all to be received with thanksgiving. Because it all comes from the hands of the Creator God, who declared it very good. Now, the gods of the Greeks of New Testament times would have had great problems with this. Because the Greek gods certainly did not believe that the physical world was good. It was evil. The spiritual was the good, and the physical was evil. Inside the physical human being was this spiritual bit which was entombed there and waiting to escape, and that was the reality, and the body was just a tomb. The God of Genesis 1 is very different from that. And I think this poem tells us that he made it. He made it. He, not it. It's not an impersonal force producing the world in which we live. It's he, not it. But it's he, not they. The gods of the world at that time were always plural, as they are in so many parts of the world even today. There are many gods. But the Hebrews who were responsible for this chapter were adamant in the whole of their history, there's only one. There's only one God. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God, the Lord is one. But we need to notice, finally, that there is a climax in the poem. It comes to a climax. And you won't be surprised to hear that the climax is it day six, before the rest day, because the guide is going to keep the climax until the end of the tour. You've been gobsmacked. You've said, wow, a number of times in the course of this tour, you've been fascinated by everything. And now I'll tell you something even greater, even more amazing, even more startling, even more disturbing. And the climax of the poem comes in verse 26. And notice that God is speaking. He's still speaking. He is the only speaker in the chapter. But notice how he speaks on this occasion. Who's he speaking to? Because he says, let us make. Is he doing a Queen Victoria? We are not amused. Or is he speaking to someone else? In verse 2, we've had mention to the Spirit of God hovering over the surface of the waters. And many years later, was it about 3,000 years later? The 43rd book of the Bible begins, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and without him was not anything made that was made. And that is the way that John introduces to the person of Jesus, the Word. The Hebrew word for God, astonishingly, is plural. And for Hebrews, plural doesn't mean more than one. In Hebrew, plural means more than two. So at a minimum, there'll be three. And do we have in this poem a little indication, a little secret, a little taster of the God of the Bible, who we're going to discover by the time we get on into the book? One God, but a Trinity within it, a Father, Son, and Spirit. And what's he talking about? I'll tell you what he's talking about. Just look around. Don't look up there. Just look across the table. Just look at anybody in the room. Yes, some of you are looking at me. Yes, and I'm looking at you. He's talking about you and me. And what is he saying? He's saying that you and I are special. Special, different from any other bit of the universe that he's traveled in. You are the masterpiece. You are the climax of it all. And you're in the image of the Creator. You're not just special, but special in your relationship with the Creator. You've got a hotline. Really? I'm fascinated, but children seem happiest when they're drawing, building, inventing, making music, making cake, making Lego, making, and not just children either. True? I'm fascinated that instinctively human beings evaluate That was a great, I nearly said sermon. No, yes, sir, that was a great sermon. Or, I'm afraid that didn't do anything for me. We evaluate. We determine whether things are good or sometimes very good. We keep on saying this. Well, why do we do it? Where's that come from? We are capable as human beings of making choices. We are free to choose to tell the truth or not. We are free to choose to keep our promises or not. And we're aware that we ought to. And where's all that come from? And there seems to be in the human being an awareness that there is someone or something out there. Call it God. An awareness. And we find ourselves speaking to him from time to time. Even the fiercest non-believer. There are times when all pray. So the God of Genesis chapter 1 is unique, different from any other God in the world. There is only one maker of heaven and earth. And this God is not just to be an object to be debated, but a person to be encountered and loved and served and reflected in the way in which we live. A friend recently gave me a book called Coming to Faith. Coming to Faith. Anybody actually seen this book? Coming to Faith. Coming to Faith through Richard Dawkins. Coming to Faith through Richard Dawkins. Now, some of you will be aware that Richard Dawkins was, amongst other things, the author of The God Delusion in 2006, declaring that there is no God, there is no need for a God, and there's no evidence for a God. So relax. And here's a book with 13 testimonies of men and women who studied Dawkins and said, this sounds great. I need to look into this. And through studying Dawkins's God Delusion and the writings of his fellow New Atheists, they have come to faith in Jesus Christ and through him discovering that they can call the Maker of heaven and earth our Father.